You're listening to a news report podcast from thebodypro.com, the HIV resource for healthcare professionals.
This is Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of The Body Pro. HIV medicine is an incredibly fast-changing field, with the treatment landscape changing dramatically every year or so. There are several reference tools meant to help clinicians keep up with this rapidly evolving knowledge. One of the most critical is a document periodically released by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, or DHHS, entitled Guidelines for the Use of Antiretroviral Agents in HIV-1 Infected Adults and Adolescents. The document is put together by a panel of 35 people. The members are mostly clinicians and researchers from universities throughout the United States, but also include a number of advocates and HIV-infected patients. The guidelines produced by the panel provide an invaluable summary of the current state of the art in antiretroviral therapy. The panel released its latest update to the guidelines on December 1, 2007, and we've asked my guest today, Dr. Joel Gallant, who is a member of that DHHS panel, to provide a summary of the update. Dr. Gallant is a widely respected HIV clinician and researcher. He's also a professor of medicine and epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in Baltimore. Welcome, Dr. Gallant.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Was this your first time serving on the panel?
It's the first set of guidelines that have come out since I've been on the panel. I've been on the panel now since the end of last year.
Uh-huh. For many years, the guidelines were a step behind what the savviest HIV specialists were doing. Do you think the guidelines have caught up to practice?
I think they're pretty responsive, but they'll always be potentially a step behind really expert clinicians just because, you know, they really depend on data that are reasonably mature, preferably published data, although certainly they do look at presented data as well. There will always be clinicians who are kind of aware of these changes, aware of very early data that are too early to be considered by the guidelines panel and are acting on those data. And those clinicians would probably say that the guidelines are a step behind. On the other hand, there are examples of situations where physicians acting on very early data have been turned out to be wrong. And so I think the guidelines sort of wait until the data are pretty clear before they'll make a recommendation based on those guidelines. So, you know, it just depends on whether the savvy clinician turns out to be right in the interpretation of the data or turns out to be wrong.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so can we just take a walk through what's new in the document?
Sure. I think the most important thing that's new is the issue of when to start. The previous set of guidelines recommended treatment for people with CD4 counts below 200 and recommended that therapy be considered in people with CD4 counts between 200 and 350. The new guidelines just come out and say that we should be treating at CD4s below 350, and this is based on a variety of considerations, most importantly some data from observational cohort studies, as well as just the changing risk-benefit ratio with the, you know, better, safer, more effective, and better tolerated therapies and increasing evidence of benefit with higher CD4 counts. The other thing that the panel does now is that they no longer define a group of people who should not be treated. In the past, they basically said if your CD4 was above 350 and your viral load was below 100,000, you should defer therapy. The current guidelines say that there are some people who should be treated at higher CD4 counts. They specifically note pregnant women, that's not a new recommendation, people with HIV-associated nephropathy or HIVAN, people who are co-infected with hepatitis B who need treatment for hepatitis B, and the reason there is because it's a lot easier to treat both infections than to try to treat hepatitis B with drugs that don't have HIV activity. And then they point out that there, you know, may be patients with higher CD4 counts for whom therapy is appropriate, just based on the potential risks and benefits and the patient's readiness and willingness to adhere to therapy. Examples might be somebody in a discordant couple with fears of transmission, people with high CD4 counts but CD4 counts that are declining rapidly, or people with very high viral loads. The panel doesn't get specific there, but they just point out that 350 is not an absolute cutoff and that you might choose to treat earlier. So that's what I consider to be the most important set of changes, but some other ones involve laboratory testing. The guidelines have been recommending baseline resistance testing with genotype tests prior to therapy in treatment-naive patients, but they now come out and say that the resistance test should be performed at the time the patient enters into clinical care, regardless of whether the plan is to initiate therapy. And the reason for that is because these tests are the most accurate shortly after infection, and with greater time, they may begin to miss the presence of resistant virus that's there in the archive, in the reservoir, or present at low levels. And so the sooner you can do the test, the better. And so the important thing is for clinicians to do the test, but then to make sure and save the results, maybe years before the patient starts therapy, and you'll want to have access to those results when you do start. The recent approval of Maraviroc has led to a recommendation that tropism testing be done prior to initiation of this drug. We know that if you have dual mixed or X4 tropic virus, you're not going to respond virologically to Maraviroc, and the other risk to using Maraviroc in that case is that you'd only be treating a portion of the viral population with the drug, and therefore, you wouldn't be protecting the other drugs in the combination against resistance. So it's very important to make sure you're using the tropism assay and only use Maraviroc in people with R5 tropic virus, keeping in mind that the tropism assay can occasionally miss low-level dual-mixed or X4 virus. So even having that test isn't complete assurance. And it also points out that you might consider doing a tropism assay again if the patient failed Maraviroc. It's unclear what you would do that information at the moment, but it may turn out to be important to know whether they failed Maraviroc because they selected out dual mixed or X4 virus, or whether they failed due to resistance. And the reason for that is because if in the future we have additional CCR5 inhibitors, those who fail with selection of X4 or dual mixed virus would not be a candidate for any of them. And then finally, they now recommend HLA-B5701 testing prior to any initiation of abacavir therapy. We've seen great data with PREDICT-1 and SHAPE showing that this is a great test to reduce the risk of HSR. If it's a positive test, the patient's very likely to develop HSR and should not take abacavir. And in fact, the guidelines recommend that abacavir allergy be listed in the patient's medical record just based on that test. If the test is negative, then it's okay to go ahead and initiate abacavir, but there have been occasional reports of HSR in people with a negative test, so you still need to counsel the patient about HSR, but the likelihood is much reduced when you use this test. And then the only other changes are just the mention of some of the newer drugs for treatment-experienced patients, raltegravir, the new integrase inhibitor, Maraviroc, which we already talked about, and then coming soon, we hope, etravirine or TMC-125, the new second-generation NNRTI. The guidelines talk about the use of these drugs. They emphasize how important it is to use these drugs in combinations that are likely to be effective to avoid resistance, and again reiterate what they've said in previous versions, that the goal of therapy now is undetectable viral load for all patients, not just treatment-naive patients. And the reason for that is because it's achievable using the right combination of these new agents. So those are the changes. What we're still waiting on now is the new guidelines for what to start with, the initial regimen, which we hope to see within the next month or two. The DHHS guidelines sometimes comes out with sections of the guidelines as they become available, since these are online guidelines rather than published. We'll be waiting for that piece to come out fairly soon.
I had one question about the final thing that you mentioned. There was a new section about immunologic failure. Uh-huh. That I had never seen before. And I was wondering if you can comment on that.
Boy, you'll have to remind me of...
It defined what it was. It was a failure to achieve adequate CD4 T-cell count, uh-huh, despite virologic suppression. It just sort of discussed that there are these patients that have persistently low CD4 T-cell count, and that there's not that much we could do about it.
Yeah, that's always been the case. There's not much you can do about it. There, I'll just speak from personal opinion here, and I'm not I'm not familiar with that section as well as I should be, so I won't talk about it per se. But, you know, there are some considerations that you might think about if somebody doesn't have a good CD4 response. One would be, are they on a drug that suppresses their bone marrow, like AZT? By getting them off AZT and onto a different drug, you might see an improvement in the lymphocyte count, which would in turn increase the CD4 count. And then there's this data from ACTG5142 and some other studies suggesting that a boosted protease inhibitor, specifically lopinavir, ritonavir, might give you a better CD4 response than efavirenz, even though in that study efavirenz was better from a virologic standpoint. So what we don't know is if somebody's on efavirenz and not having a desirable CD4 response, will you get a better response by switching them to, say, lopinavir, ritonavir? We don't have those data to know, but, you know, it's interesting to just kind of speculate. But for the most part, if you've suppressed the viral load, you've done what you can do, and there's not a lot of other things that you can do. And usually, in most cases, it is not an indication to change the regimen, with the possible exceptions of the things I mentioned.
How often do you think these guidelines are used by the typical practitioner? I mean, so I think a lot of – it's not as read as often as it should be, I guess, I was trying to say.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, one of the problems is the guidelines document is quite long. It's quite detailed. And it's really an excellent document for finding out, you know, all the latest information on HIV therapy. And I think, unfortunately, what happens is people think of the guidelines as just a bunch of tables, and they know what's in the tables about when to start and what to start with, but not enough people actually read the document in its entirety. And I think, you know, even if you already are way ahead of things and you're an expert clinician and you're practicing, you know, kind of ahead of the guidelines, and you've already been treating people below 350 and all that kind of thing, I think you can still learn a lot from actually reading the document. You know, often when I have to go to some place to get references or to make sure I'm thinking of the right studies, you know, I'll often use this as a tool because it's such a comprehensive discussion of the issue.
Do you keep this on your PDA or...?
Well, I don't have it on my PDA, but I have it on all my computers, including a PDF version of the latest guidelines. And, of course, you can just go online and read it. It is lengthy, like I said, but well worth the trouble.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, thank you, Dr. Gallant, for taking the time to talk with us.
My pleasure.
This has been a news report from thebodypro.com. The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us at news@thebodypro.com.